Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Throughout his campaign for the presidency, Donald Trump vowed to end the war on coal, in his words, and President Obama's Clean Power Plan. He also suggested that the EPA might disappear. 2 months into his office, the administration and congressional Republicans are quickly moving this agenda forward. Congress has repealed a rule protecting waterways from coal waste. The administration has called for a 25% cut to the EPA's budget, which would zero out nearly two dozen programs, including the Clean Power Plan. Trump has also signed executive orders to advance the construction of the Keystone XL and Dakota Access oil pipelines. You can find the roadmap to repeal many Obama-era protections being pushed by conservative groups like Freedom Partners and ALEC, the American Legislative Council. Last year, ALEC introduced model legislation to repeal the U.S. Department of Interior's Stream Protection Rule, and that ensures that coal mining operations do not damage nearby streams and waterways. Joining us to talk about the implications of the actions we have seen so far and what's to come are two guests. William Snape is senior counsel for the Center for Biological Diversity, an organization that works to protect the lands, waters, and climate that species need to survive. William teaches at American University's Washington College of Law, and he's editor of Biodiversity and the Law, which is published by Island Press. And William Snape joins us on the line from Washington. Hi, William. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Jack Cushman is editor and reporter for Inside Climate News, a Pulitzer Prize-winning nonprofit news organization dedicated to covering climate change, energy, and the environment. Before joining Inside Climate News, Jack spent 35 years as a writer and editor in D.C., mostly with the Washington Bureau of the New York Times. Jack is author of Keystone and Beyond, Tar Sands and the National Interest in the Era of Climate Change. And Jack Cushman joins us on the line from New Hampshire. Hi, Jack. Welcome back.
Hello, Rose. Glad to be here.
Great to have you. So we're 2 months into this administration, and we have seen so many changes that will affect the environment. Before we talk about specifics, William Snape, let's start off with you. Let's talk about where these decisions are coming from. Because if you look at ALEC's website, again, this is the American Legislative Exchange Council. This is a group that is funded by corporations. These corporations and state politicians vote behind closed doors to try to rewrite state laws. Almost all of the executive orders and these rules that Trump has overturned or instated were written by ALEC. You can see it right on their website.
Absolutely. And in fact, not only written by ALEC, written by the Koch brothers and not only major corporations, but basically the far right of the far right, who has had it in their sights to destroy environmental rules and regulations for several decades. Yes, it is a wish list of environmental destruction, ALEC.
Who has a seat at the table? I mean, when you look at ALEC and you follow the money, who is actually making these decisions?
The oil and gas industry is making these decisions. The coal industry have a hand in this decision. The minerals industry has a hand. The timber industry, all of the basic moneyed interests that want to roll back public interest in environmental protections. And I think what's interesting about Donald Trump is during the Republican campaign, we forget that even some of those so-called mainstream Republican candidates, they weren't embracing ALEC, certainly not all of them. So Trump really was embracing the most extreme of his party's views. And of course, now this has become national policy, at least on some level, before we defeat it, of course.
And Jack, what would you add to this? If you go to ALEC.org, you can find a resolution concerning the Stream Protection Rule, resolution concerning the combined impacts of future EPA regulations for coal-fired power plants. On their environment and agriculture page, they've got a lot of different laws and charters.
Well, it's not just ALEC, which operates largely at the state level, as opposed to the federal level, but a wide variety of think tanks, trade associations, and interest groups who what they have in common is funding from the fossil fuel and related industries and an agenda that's driven by those industries. And it's really so clear that it scarcely requires discussion. You have an administration that came in. Remember that Trump, when he first spelled out his energy platform, essentially described an America First and fossil fuel energy production agenda. And his essential view was that fossil fuels that are in the ground constitute an enormous source of wealth, and it should be pulled out of the ground and that wealth captured. Of course, we know that the science of climate change, which is where I focus my attention, dictates that most of the known reserves of fossil fuel on the planet have to be left in the ground. And so that's anathema to this ideology, and therefore what the administration is doing is systematically going across the policy agenda and removing strictures on the production of fossil fuels just as a matter of policy. And it shouldn't be surprising, given that Trump himself has declared that he doesn't believe the climate science. Michael Spence, the vice president, is of a similar view, and so are most of the cabinet officials who have been put into the cognizant agencies of the federal government. So we shouldn't be surprised to see them doing what they said they were going to do.
And William, can you talk about the significance of Steve Bannon, Donald Trump's chief strategist, saying that their goal is to deconstruct the administrative state? He said that at the CPAC conference recently.
And those were comments that were echoed again by the president himself. Yes, I think this is really the ultimate goal here, is to put people in place of these agencies who then destroy the agencies. Rick Perry, head of the Department of Energy, once called for the abolition of that department. Mr. Pruitt, head of EPA, sued the agency multiple times. So I think what you're going to see over the course of at least the next couple of months before Congress and the American people just have enough is you're going to see these agencies on enforcement matters do absolutely nothing. This will be industry's Christmas Day over and over again. And on the issue of formulating positive policy, trying to do anything with the reins of government, I think you'll just see them throwing sand in the gears. It's going to be a destruction type of model, and they're not going to seek to accomplish anything proactive except allowing oil and gas to be pumped from our public lands and basically from every corner of the country. That I think Jack is right that the agenda here is to literally pull up as much gas, coal, and oil as they can, no matter where it is, no matter how much harm is caused by it, because this is an administration focused on very short-term profits to the expense of everything else.
And Jack, before we talk about specific changes, is there anything else we need to know about Scott Pruitt? I mean, it's been widely reported that as Oklahoma's attorney general, he sued the EPA many times. He's got very close ties to the fossil fuel industry. Based on you and your team's reporting, is there anything else that we need to know about Scott Pruitt, who is now head of the EPA?
Well, now that he's in office, I think we knew about his background, and we know what his views are on the legal issues from his record in court. A record, by the way, which does not show many victories in the court cases. And I'm not a lawyer. I'll ask William to tell us a little more about the legal prospects for this agenda that they're pursuing, because I think that they may find themselves surprised by some of the legal obstacles that are remain in front of them. However, what we are seeing from Scott Pruitt now is the degree to which he's what you would have to call a split customer. In other words, he's coming into the EPA with a very overt agenda, but he's describing it in a very interesting way. He's saying, what I want to do is, A, get this agency back to its original core mission of protecting air and water, and B, make it stop exercising authorities which it's not given by law. And he is wrong, and he knows he's wrong, on both of these counts. On count B, that the agency is overstepping the law, just look at the Clean Power Plan, which is about to be revoked by the administration if they can legally do so, which is the question. The Supreme Court has ruled not once, but three times, that the Clean Air Act delegates to the EPA the responsibility to control emissions of carbon dioxide if they're found to endanger public health and the environment. They have been found to do that. There's a strong scientific consensus. And so, therefore, the EPA, under our laws, is required to regulate this form of pollution. Now, as to his claim, which you also hear from Donald Trump, that we just want to clean up the air and clean up the water and not go down these secondary paths, first of all, that's not true. They have fought regulations to clean up the air and the water. But secondly, the climate actions they're taking are going to have secondary effects, which make it much harder to clean up the air and clean up the water. We know that the Clean Power Plan will have a secondary benefit of reducing smog, and it's smog that kills people today. Carbon dioxide in the air takes longer to do its damage. So it's the job of the press, I think, to hold this rhetoric up to scrutiny and to make sure that we're doing what we can to explain in kind of comprehensive detail for the long haul what the real implications of this agenda are.
Hmm. Jackie's exactly correct, and if I could just explicate on two quick air examples. The Obama administration spent a lot of time on both their automobile fuel efficiency standards and, as Jack just relayed, the Clean Power Plan. So a lot on automobiles and a lot on the power plants that create pollution for that hurts public health and harms our climate. In both instances, the Obama administration eventually took positions that were incredibly modest, incredibly centrist. The automobile standards, for instance, our automobile standards, even in 10 years from now under the Obama plan, will still be weaker than those that exist in Europe and Japan, for instance. Under the Clean Power Plan, the targets that the states all received were very easy to meet, and in many ways the Clean Power Plan was really just a soft landing to get states and private entities to look at renewable energy more seriously. In both instances, Scott Pruitt is just hyperbolically against these very reasonable, modest increments of progress. And it just makes you scratch your head and wonder what his ultimate objective is. And to me, his ultimate objective is to give industry whatever they want. And that was clearly his track record in Oklahoma, which is very poor. He leaves a legacy of pollution, of illness, and of a lot of bad governing. So this is someone who has been brought in to destroy the very agency he's going to lead.
If I might chime in on question of how easy it is to meet the standards. I mean, you can take some comfort from the fact that the United States is already well along the way to meeting the Clean Power Plan objectives, even though they don't begin to take hold until 2022. The markets have been moving this country in the direction of the cheapest available form of energy that there is, and it's moving us through a progression through natural gas, but toward cheap, free renewables, and that means wind and solar. And so there is some possibility that what we'll see here is 4 years of litigation over the Clean Power Plan, the end of which its objectives will actually have been met. Now, that's not entirely a reason to shrug and say, oh, well, never mind, because these objectives, as easy as they are to meet, are inadequate to the task of reining in climate change. So what's needed now is higher ambition. And instead of higher ambition, we're seeing lower ambition.
Jack Cushman is editor and reporter with Inside Climate News, a nonprofit news organization dedicated to covering climate change. And William Snape is senior counsel for the Center for Biological Diversity, an organization that works to protect the lands, waters, and climate that species need to survive. And today, we are talking about the changes that we are seeing under the Trump White House. White House and congressional Republicans are moving very, very quickly to dismantle climate change protections, drastically cut budgets for the Environmental Protection Act and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. We'll talk about specifics later in the show. A lot of these protections, the repeal of these protections, are being pushed by conservative groups like Freedom Partners and ALEC, the American Legislative Council. The New York Times actually has a really long article today called Leashes Come Off Wall Street, Gun Sellers, Polluters, and More. The New York Times took a tally of regulations and found that about 90 regulations have been delayed, suspended, or reversed in the month and a half since Trump took office, including a lot of things that would affect the environment. So if you have any questions or comments about these changes, we'd love to hear from you. If you work on environmental issues, what concerns you the most? And then so many things are moving so quickly. How will this affect us in the long term? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. There's so much news coming out, and it's really hard to keep track of anything. So now is your chance to ask our guests who focus very specifically on environmental issues about what we are seeing, the changes that we're seeing. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So people are totally overwhelmed. I mean, just reading some headlines, the EPA to pull back on fuel efficiency standards for cars, trucks in future model years, Washington Post. Inside Climate News, Trump's EPA halts request for methane information from oil and gas producers. Inside Climate News, Washington Post, White House eyes plan to cut EPA staff by one-fifth, eliminating key programs. William, we're going to talk specifics, but when you look at all of these changes, how do you think that they will affect the long view? I mean, how will this affect future generations?
Well, if the Trump administration gets their way, it will give future generations a practically dead world. So our goal is to stop that. And, you know, it is depressing. It is a sort of daily, hourly onslaught. But I will say two things that give me some degree of optimism. One is that all of the things that Trump is doing unilaterally, or at least his agencies will also begin to do unilaterally, we're going to beat them in court. They can't do the things that they want to do. So the court system is going to be a very important lever in this battle. The second thing is more nuanced, but I think maybe even more important in the long run, which is we've been over these first several months focused on the Senate and the Congress on votes that where the Senate only needs 50 votes to pass things. With the Congressional Review Act and with these cabinet nominations. Soon we will enter a period where to pass real legislation and to pass real funding bills, they're going to need 60 votes. And you can already see Republicans beginning to resist and not want to go along with their president. We're not there all the way yet, but you're beginning to see the early signs of it. And I predict by late spring or summer, we could be seeing full chaos even within the Republican Party. That's a little maybe optimistic from an environmental point of view, but some of the things the administration are proposing are just so far outside the pale, so radically wrong that, people like Susan Collins, people like Lindsey Graham are going to say enough's enough. We want to govern, not to run an insane asylum.
Are you hearing this from any of these Republicans?
Well, you saw it on some of the nomination votes. The DeVos vote needed the vice president to break the tie. You're seeing it a little bit with these bizarre Russia tweets that the president is issuing, where Republicans are publicly questioning his veracity and his evidence on these claims. So it's not going to happen overnight because this is a party dependent upon their president on some level. So there's a lot of fear. But I think at some point, if it's between getting reelected in a year and a half or going down some sort of insane hole, I think most people are going to want to get reelected. And you're going to start seeing some real divisions. And I think healthcare is where it's all going to pop up first. I know that's not what we're talking about here, but the fact that the Republicans have no idea how to replace the healthcare system that's been put in place, you know, it says volumes about their ability to govern.
And what do you think, Jack?
Well, I would say that one area that we have seen signs of what Bill is talking about is in the town hall meetings, where people have been disturbed enough by these early indications that they started to turn out in great numbers at town hall meetings and voice their objections to the direction that their elected representatives are taking. I think that the protest march in Washington right after the inauguration was, truly a striking event. And I lived most of my adult life in Washington within a few miles of the mall, and have seen many protests go by my window, but that was a very unusual event.
Hmm.
We now have a couple of more important events like that to come around April 22nd, I believe, Earth Day. The scientists are having a march on Washington.
Right.
And there are many, many scientists working for the federal government or involved in federal programs. You know, inside the Beltway is a dense population of scientists. That Montgomery County, where I used to live in Maryland, 60% of the households had somebody with a degree beyond college living in the household, so masters and PhDs. National Institutes of Health, NASA, the military-industrial complex, the Environmental and Land Management Agencies, NOAA, the Space Agency. All of these are populated by scientists who know that science doesn't work if you don't pay attention to reality. And they're quite upset to see the direction that the science budget is going. And so while this won't be a gigantic march, it will be a profoundly influential march. Now, I heard a local New Hampshire scientist make a presentation up here where I live last week, and he was asked about scientists' obligations to speak out on public policy. And he said, as many scientists will say these days, you know, I used to be kind of standoffish, and I would just present the science, and I didn't try to translate it to policy. But the Union of Concerned Scientists gave me a call and asked me to come down and talk to my senators from Maine in April. And I think I'm going to do it because I can see that the direction of our policy is antithetical to the science that I've spent my life studying. I think you're going to find a very strong component. This is what I call the credibility gap, to resurrect the phrase from the Vietnam War, that if the nation's policy is out of sync with reality, the credibility gap was the most damaging thing that LBJ finally confronted. And I think that we're going to see a credibility gap emerging on the environmental scene. And then just a week later, just at the end of April, the environmental movement is also organizing its own demonstration. I think turning out in the streets doesn't always work. I mean, after all, there was a huge demonstration in New York a couple of years ago, and it didn't translate into the exercise of political will. But it can work, and members of Congress are going to be paying attention to what their constituents are telling them.
And so many scientists and conservationists we've had on the show say that they're very concerned about these budget cuts that are planned. The Washington Post has a story about plans to cut EPA staff by one-fifth. As a candidate, Donald Trump vowed to get rid of the EPA in almost every form, leaving, quote, little tidbits intact. Jack, before we go to break, can you talk about the significance of possibly dropping the EPA's budget, cutting the budget from $8.2 billion a year to $6.1 billion a year? Under this plan, the EPA staff would be slashed from its current level of 15,000 to 2,000.
That would be slashed by 2,000 or 3,000 from the current level to about 12,000. Here's the thing that people have to understand. First of all, the EPA hasn't operated at that level of staffing and budget, even absent inflation, since the 1980s. And since then, there have been major environmental statutes and responsibilities put on the agency. So these are really draconian cuts. The second thing is, very little of the EPA's budget goes to, let's say, climate science. Most of what the EPA does, it's actual enforcement of environmental laws. And I had a glimpse of this early in my career in the years in which, if you remember, Bill Clinton vetoed a spending bill that was going to make deep cuts, and the EPA went through a period of 30 days of furloughs between, I believe it was, I'm forgetting the years, 1990 maybe. But there was an immediate effect on enforcement. And I remember reporting situations where people were calling into the EPA and saying, there are barrels of PCBs just sitting out here in the driveway and we're really worried about it. Can you send somebody around to check it out? And the EPA had to say, no, we can't. Most EPA spending and most EPA employment is spent on enforcing and protecting you against the actual kind of pollution crisis. And that's going to hit home very fast if you have this level of cut. And people are going to be quite upset to find out that their Superfund cleanup has come to a halt, that they can't, that their factory can't get a permit, that the water is spewing into the stream. green and nobody's around to do anything about it. All politics is finally local, and this is going to cause some real local consternation. Nobody wants to have their drinking water hurting their kids, and you can't run this system on a bare-bones enforcement budget and avoid having that kind of crisis bubble up.
And according to this piece, 38 separate programs would be eliminated entirely. Grants to clean up brownfields, abandoned industrial sites, also on the chopping block climate change initiatives and funding for Alaskan Native villages. And William, in this story, William Becker, executive director of the National Association of Clean Air Energies, says that if these cuts are enacted, they will rip the heart and soul out of the National Air Pollution Control Program and jeopardize the health and welfare of tens of millions of people around the country. What would you add?
Absolutely, and it would be a complete disaster. And, of course, they're taking away all the funding for NOAA to do all its incredible scientific research. But I'd like to point out on this example, as wretched and horrible as it all is, and it is all those things, that, again, congressional Republicans have already begun to balk. Mike Simpson, hardly a liberal wallflower from the state of Idaho, chairman of the House Interior Appropriations Committee, has said, no thanks. We're not going down that road. So I think that, you know, there'll be battles. Maybe the Trump administration will, you know, actually start doing its job and, you know, negotiating with Congress. But I don't think Congress is going to go along. And if the administration continues on this rhetoric and of these types of actions, I just don't even see the House going along. And remember, the House is that has, you know, at least 100 of the most rabid Republican, you know, far-right Republicans that are the most ardent of the Trump supporters. It's the Senate usually that's going to slow things down. But here on the spending, this ridiculous spending idea by Trump, again, even the Republican congressman from Idaho is saying no go.
William Snape is senior counsel for the Center for Biological Diversity, and Jack Cushman is editor and reporter with Inside Climate News. Today on Your Call, we are talking about environmental protections and rollbacks under Donald Trump's administration. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. You can also post a comment or question to our website, yourcallradio.org, or you may tweet us at Your Call Radio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, speaking of the fate of the planet, the Ocean Film Festival kicks off on Thursday. It's an amazing festival. I hope you can check it out. We're going to talk about one of the documentaries that's being shown called Freightened, The Real Cost of Shipping. They're talking about freights. 90% of the things we consume are manufactured in other countries and are delivered by ship. But the cargo shipping industry is largely unknown to most people. It's a key player in the world economy. So we're going to talk about the biggest players and how this industry is regulated. That's tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about environmental regulations and protections and budget cuts to the EPA, for example, or NOAA, under Donald Trump and congressional Republicans. There's so much happening so quickly, and if you can't keep up, you're not alone. So now is the time to give us a call to ask our guests about all of the different headlines that you have been seeing. Trump directs EPA to begin dismantling clean water rule. Trump halts request for methane information from oil and gas producers. We're talking about what this actually means and what this will mean for future generations with William Snape, senior counsel for the Center for Biological Diversity, and Jack Cushman, editor and reporter with Inside Climate News. And let's hear from Kathleen in San Francisco. Hi, Kathleen. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I just have three quick questions that are sort of clarifications of what they've been talking about. I don't remember which of the guests said that so far regulations, 90 regulations have been delayed, suspended, or reversed. 90. And my question is that referring, that isn't referring to just Trump's executive orders, that also include what the Congressional Review Act has allowed Congress to do, or possibly new legislation? In other words, those 90 regulations that have been, you know, zotted, have it been all of the above, or...
Yes, so let's tackle that one. The New York Times has a piece today, and they have looked at regulations. And everything from Verizon and AT&T will no longer have to take reasonable measures to ensure customer social security numbers are not stolen. For example, the Social Security Administration will no longer be used to try to block individuals with disabling mental health issues from buying handguns. When it comes to the environment, lawyers representing the National Mining Association, the American Petroleum Institute, and other fossil fuel trade groups and companies asked the Interior Department last month to suspend a new rule changing the way companies pay royalties for oil, gas, or coal extracted from federal lands. So the New York Times looked at all of the regulations across the board.
What I'm wondering is, are these regulations that are being derailed, is it Congress you're talking about, Trump, executive orders, or both?
This is Bill Snape, and I'll let Jack, he's the one who had the number, but it's all of the above, at least. I don't know what the 90 number came from, but most of what's occurred so far have occurred through either Trump executive orders, which, by the way, most of them have limited legal power. It's another topic we can get into later, but either Trump executive orders or the Congressional Review Act process, that truncated congressional review of Obama regulations passed late in his administration. There might have been there very little has happened at the agencies themselves yet, because the Trump administration was so inefficient and slow that it finally just has its cabinet in place. So the agencies themselves haven't really begun trying to dismantle all those rules yet. But it's mostly been through CRA and Trump executive orders.
And William, can you please give us a little 101 on the Congressional Review Act? Because I'm guessing that most of us are not familiar with this. And Public Citizen has a website called rulesatrisk.org. And they say that the CRA is a holdover from Newt Gingrich's contract with America. Can you describe how this works exactly?
Absolutely. What the Congressional Review Act essentially says is that any administration, late in its tenure, if it attempts to and does pass regulations in the sort of last several months of an administration, the new Congress gets 60 congressional days to review those regulations. Now, how they count those 60 days is a little bit in question, and I'm hearing different estimates as to when this whole process will end. But assuming that 60 days really means 60 days, sometime around May 1st of this year, could be a little later maybe, the Congress will no longer have the ability to use the Congressional Review Act, because by the Congressional Review Act's own terms, the period of time to look at those Obama regulations has passed. And the other thing about the Congressional Review Act is they can't look at all of the Obama rules. They can only look at Obama rules that were passed late in the administration, and there's a sort of complicated way in which the legislation lays it out, but essentially regulations by Obama and the administration after June 3rd of 2016 are subject to the CRA. Anything passed or promulgated before that is safe. So that's basically CRA 101 for you. It's real fascinating stuff.
Yeah, no, it's very important.
But it is important.
Yes, very important. And Jack, did you want to jump in there?
Well, I would add a couple of things. One is that the Congressional Review Act can be used theoretically at any time. If President Trump were to pass a regulation, Congress would now have that same set of legislative days in order to review it, and if they didn't like it, to overturn it. So it's only really meaningful right now because the new Congress is going after regulations that were relatively recently enacted. The second thing is, it only requires 50 votes in the Senate to overturn a regulation, and so that's another peculiarity of the CRA. And the third thing is, there is a provision in the CRA which says a future administration cannot, or an agency cannot, come back ever and attempt to do essentially the same thing or even to address the subject in future regulation. That is such an extraordinary assertion of congressional power that it requires a court test, and this law has never been tested in court. So we're not at all sure that what's done cannot be undone. The balance of powers would always suggest that a future government can come and reconsider the actions of a previous government. And I think that the CRA, having never been tested in court, remains somewhat frail. The other thing that I would like to point out is that there is a general freeze on new regulations. That's one way that regulations have been delayed. There are the Congressional Review Act reversals of existing regulations, so that's another way that this has happened. A third way that this is happening is with Trump administration attempts to reverse decisions that were made by the Obama administration. One example would be the Clean Power Plan for dirty power plants, and the other would be the reversal of decisions about fuel efficiency and tailpipe standards for automobiles. So these are multiple paths, and in this case, all roads lead to the same nirvana for the fossil fuel industry.
And again, this website, the really important information here is rules, plural, rulesatrisk.org, and we'll put a link at yourcallradio.org. Kathleen, are you still with us?
Yes.
Okay. You had a few more questions.
Well, it was just one. He mostly answered everything. Well, the good news is that right now under the CRA they only need 50 votes to do that damage. But once the CRA is no longer in force, they'll have to do regular legislation in order to do things right, and that will take more votes. So it's easier for them to do damage during this period, and. I assume that they would have to have the regular. I mean, obviously, the regular Senate majority would be required for regular legislation, and that will slow them up and slow up the impetus a little.
Right. Yeah.
That's absolutely right, with one big exception, which are pieces of legislation called budget reconciliation bills. And I don't want to drag our listeners into this dark hole, but essentially, budget reconciliation bills can only deal with things that are related to the budget, obviously, but some of the thinking is that the Republicans are going to try to pass health care through a budget reconciliation process that also only needs 50 votes. Kathleen and Jack are both really right. This 50 versus 60 vote threshold is really important. When we do have the 60 vote threshold, it means some of the crazier stuff can't get through because enough Republicans, you know, are like, no, well, this is nuts. When you've got a 50 vote, it really is harder to keep everyone in line. And so the 60 vote threshold will be an important issue.
And on that point, we have an email from Alicia who says, what's the best way we as citizens can let Trump and his cabinet know that we oppose these horrifying measures to favor corporations over the environment?
Well, my initial inclination would be to contact your two senators and your member of Congress and get to know them personally, and don't just send them emails and don't even just call them up. Show up. Demand a meeting. That's what democracy is all about. Now, I've heard through the grapevines that Paul Ryan now is no longer even accepting calls or faxes or voicemails anymore. So Paul Ryan's running a bit scared. But most members of Congress and senators, they stand up when enough people want to hear from them. And I know it's hard work, and I know people have things they need to do. But the only way we're going to, in my view, turn this around is have members of Congress feel the heat.
Jack, anything to add there?
Well, yes, I would add something, and it may be a little off of what the listener is asking, but it's important for everybody to learn how to listen. It's important for journalists to learn how to listen, and it's important for citizens to learn how to listen. You're not going to be able always to just shout down your opponent, and some of the most effective strategies for achieving change in a democracy require that you sit down and talk to somebody whom you disagree. And one very effective way to go about this, at least in the climate space, is to talk to this person about what it is that they value that might be lost in a world in which the climate changes. So that I might not agree with every cousin in my family. I'm not speaking about my actual cousins, but in a theoretical sense. But if we all have a share in the same house on an island in Maine, then we all might consider together what it would mean if sea level rise were to have our family and future generations in our family lose that thing that we all value. Mm. So when I sit with a scientist and hear that in New Hampshire we're going to have, instead of the usual 4 or 5 days every summer that are above 90 degrees, which is why I chose to go to college every summer in New Hampshire, that it's now going to be 50 days every summer that are above 90 degrees, that I might as well have gone to college in North Carolina for the climate as one in New Hampshire, then that's something that I valued and that I would like my children to be able to enjoy summers in New England. And you need to have those conversations with people who are not inside your own ideological or personal thought bubble. Mm. I think that's one of the most effective things people can do.
Well, thank you for the email, Alicia. Thank you for the call, Kathleen. And that is Jack Cushman, editor and reporter for Inside Climate News. And William Snape is senior counsel for the Center for Biological Diversity. We are talking about the environment under Trump. And if you have any questions or comments, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. If you work on these issues, if you care about these issues, what concerns you the most? There's so much happening so quickly, and William and Jack follow these issues very closely. So now is the time to give them a call if you have any questions or comments about what's happening. And let's go next to Heather in Oakland. Hi, Heather. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hi. Thank you. We've heard the story over the weekend and the piece about the Native Alaskan villages and why he in particular is going after them, you know, at the moment. Of all the Native people, is it because of the oil industry up there? Is it something with Sarah Palin? Why the Alaskan villages is my question.
Well, I just looked this up. Alaska Public Media reports that Alaska receives about $78 million a year in grants and contracts from the EPA. This money helps villages install new water and wastewater systems, so fewer communities have to rely on unsafe drinking water. It helps villages improve existing systems. William, can you talk about this? Because it's not just Alaska. The Guardian had a piece that said these cuts will hit communities of color the hardest.
Well, absolutely. I mean, look at Flint, Michigan, which still doesn't have clean water a year and a half after that crisis hit them. And you're going to see a lot more Flint, Michigans if these proposals go through. And I wanted to pick up on something Jack touched upon and I've mentioned a little bit, but this idea that we're going to drill for oil and gas and, I guess, blow up more mountains for coal everywhere it exists. And, of course, not only is that destructive for the environment and destructive for people and destructive for future generations and destructive to the land, it doesn't even make any economic sense. And so, we're at a point right now with this administration where I think people are just going to have to say enough is enough. And I agree with Jack that we have to listen, but I'm not convinced the Trump administration is into listening. I'm not suggesting he said otherwise. So I think that it, as relates to some things, like clean water in communities that is objectively and tangibly being harmed, people are going to have to make noise and people are going to have to be heard, or otherwise nothing will happen. And it will be distressing and interesting to see, you know, how this plays out over the course of the next couple of months, because I think there will be more stories like this, not less.
And Jack, in this article, Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski, who chairs the Appropriations Subcommittee that drafts the spending bill for the EPA, says, quote, "We do as appropriators need to be prepared for a budget that on the discretionary side is probably going to look pretty aggressive," end quote. So what
I'm not sure what she means. When she says we need to be prepared for it, does she mean that she needs to accept it? The problems of Alaska are peculiar to Alaska, but the generic problem that we're addressing here is a failure to understand that environmental protections and protections from a changing climate are most important to the people who have least resources. Mm. And it was particularly distressing, therefore, to see in the draft budget that was circulated for the EPA out of OMB, the budget that leaked to the Washington Post, that one of the programs which would be eliminated would be the environmental justice program, at the Environmental Protection Agency. That is nothing other than an attempt to steer resources to the most disadvantaged and the most vulnerable. And it's hard to justify it on the basis of dollars and cents, because so few dollars and so few cents are dribbled to those communities by our existing programs. And to attack those programs in order to sustain a 10% or $54 billion increase in defense spending, when we already spend on defense more than all other major economies in the world combined, seems like a penny foolish as well as a pound foolish approach.
Well, William, in the Guardian piece, John Coquette, a campaign director with the Sierra Club, did not mince words, saying, quote, "To cut the environmental justice programs at EPA is just racist. I can't describe it in any other terms than a move to leave those communities behind. I can't imagine what the justification would be other than racism."
Well, I would agree with that, and I would even, it's hard to pile on to something like that, but I would pile on and say people are going to die. People are going to get sick, and people are going to die. And, you know, these numbers that EPA puts out on what happens when you have dirty air and dirty water, you know, sometimes it's easy to just read that as an internet number and have it be some sort of a detached thing. And I think, unfortunately, we're in a situation now where it's going to become all too real. And the Environmental Protection Agency and many of the state agencies that work with the EPA, and that's actually a very important fact, over the course of the last 40 years, state agencies, all 50 of them, even in Texas, work very well with EPA on these very infrastructure things that Jack was mentioning. All of a sudden that goes up in smoke. You're going to be having sickness and death. You're going to be increasing health care. I mean, we're talking about a potential real human health disaster.
Mm. What about the health of the planet? I mean, we've done shows about, you know, the species extinction. I mean, what happens to the planet also under these changes?
Well, I'll let Jack take a first big crack at that, but I will just say that one of the most befuddling things about this administration is how they seem to have no interest in renewable energy. Because if you take the idea that they just are interested in short-term profits no matter where they are, which is the allegation I'm making, as Jack indicated, solar and wind, particularly solar, are doing very, very well in many areas right now.
Hmm.
Yet the administration seems to be purposely putting its head in the sand on that. So it seems like not only are they sticking their head in the sand environmentally, they're sticking their head in the sand economically. They're picking winners, their favorite buddies, who just all happen to be in the oil and gas industry.
Jack, can you elaborate on that? Can you talk about the forces within the administration who are opposed to clean energy?
You know, it's kind of odd to talk about forces within the administration, because the administration barely exists at this point. There are maybe 600 positions that need to be filled in the government and confirmed by the Senate. I think maybe two dozen of those jobs have been filled at this point. It might be up to three dozen. For most of the jobs, nobody has been put into place. And so what you have is a kind of irrational exuberance of an administration that is making decisions without any substantial analysis going into them. And so sometimes the decisions are completely irrational. Without getting to the merits of the Keystone Pipeline, for Donald Trump to suggest that he was going to require TransCanada to make that pipeline entirely out of American steel was just nonsense. He has no authority to tell TransCanada what kind of steel to purchase. But on top of that, the steel for the pipeline was purchased this long ago and has been sitting out in fields. We saw pictures of Barack Obama standing in front of piles of those pipes during the 2012 campaign. So it was a policy decision being made in a vacuum of information. And I think that it's very important to realize that as time goes on, policy decisions are going to have to be justified before neutral audiences and with credible evidence if we're to have any sort of regular order in the government.
Well, and I just want to add, and maybe my last real major point of this great dialogue is that I fear that as the days and weeks go on and the administration feels more besieged and is creating more enemies, that they're just going to create more outrageous stories. They're going to disregard facts even more, and we're going to be in a situation come summer where, you know, we don't know which way is up and which way is down. And of course, I think that's the Trump administration's goal, is to sow that type of chaos. That you look at any type of dictatorial regime, and they like to play with the facts. So that my only concern on all this over the next couple is, because there is so much out there, as you said, that our democracy will feel strained, and it is difficult to keep up with a president who tweets nonsense on an hourly basis. I mean, it is, we laugh about it, and it's the new normal, but it's bizarre, and it makes being a civil society very difficult, challenging, to say the least.
And inevitably, we get so many emails and phone calls from people saying, yes, I call my congressperson and my senator. In California, there's not that much difference between politicians, Democrats. But people say, I've given money to good organizations, made calls to senators to block Pruitt's confirmation. What else?
Well, I would say that the two big things are, one, to just keep applying that pressure. It sometimes seems as though it's hopeless or helpless, but endless pressure, endlessly applied. We are in a battle right now, and we just have to keep fighting. I think the other thing that I would suggest to people is, in supporting organizations, and obviously I would love people to support my organization, but to pick any entity that they believe is doing good social justice work and help them out. If you help them out with money, that's fine. You know, go to meetings. I think just having people and personal engagement with people who are standing up for democratic ideals, I think that is actually a very important step, and that's what I would suggest as a way of getting involved.
William Snape is senior counsel for the Center for Biological Diversity, and Jack Cushman is editor and reporter for Inside Climate News. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you. And you can find articles about these specific issues if you want more information about these rollbacks at yourcallradio.org. Tomorrow, we're talking about what we need to know about the shipping industry. We'll have a conversation about a new documentary called Freightened, The Real Cost of Shipping. 90% of the things we buy are manufactured in other countries and are delivered by ship. So what do we need to know about this massive industry? Who are the biggest players, and how is it regulated? The Ocean Film Festival kicks off on Thursday. I hope you can check out some of those films. Your Call is produced here at KALW. If you'd like to listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produced today's show. Stephanie Porcel is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. You can email us, feedback@yourcallradio.org. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Thanks for joining us.